Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chimanchu, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Sam Mazur, and our super producer, Sydney Engel. Say hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey.
Our guest tonight is Dr. Carmen Tong to discuss urinary incontinence. But first, Sam, do you want to remind all of us, the audience and me, about what this show is all about?
Chris, I'd absolutely like to remind you about what this show is about now that we are over 100 episodes in. So are the pediatric medicine podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Carmen Tong. Dr. Tong is a pediatric urologist and director of pediatric robotic surgery at Children's of Alabama. She completed her urology residency at Einstein Healthcare Network in Philadelphia and fellowship training in pediatric urology at Monroe Carroll Jr. Children's Hospital at Vanderbilt in Nashville. Dr. Tong's clinical practice and research is dedicated to spina bifida, kidney stones, and children with voiding dysfunction. She has authored over 40 peer-reviewed publications and book chapters, and her research has been presented at every major urologic society nationwide. She currently is an assistant professor of urology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. In this episode, Dr. Tong teaches us about the first-line treatments for incontinence, PVRs, and how bed alarms really work.
What do you think, guys? No need to hold back on jumping into this episode. It's going to flow right into our main discussion. It's going to be a huge stream of evidence. So let's investigate this trickle of symptoms.
There we go. That was well done, Chris.
That was solid.
Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Tong.
Thank you for having me.
First, because we're sort of an informal group, can I ask you, is it okay to call you by your first name?
Yes, absolutely. Please.
Okay. So it's Carmen, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Excellent, excellent. So I want to start off with some, you know, quick questions, just some warm-up questions just to get to know you a little better. Could you give us a couple lines about yourself, about who you are and maybe something outside of medicine?
Okay. Well, my name is Carmen Tong. I'm a pediatric urologist, which means I see and operate on children with genital and urinary issues. I do a lot of research in surgical and robotic education for trainees. So that's medical students and residents. And I also have a passion for reproductive and sexual health in individuals with spina bifida. In my free time, I very much enjoy traveling with my husband, and I'm a big fan of sushi.
Nice.
What kind of sushi?
Ooh, you know, we just got back from Japan for our honeymoon, so I really like all kinds of sushi. I feel like I've gotten to be a little bit of a snob here in Birmingham because we're landlocked. We really don't have access to very super fresh fish. We do have a lot of like Gulf Coast stuff, like oysters and crawfish. And so I've resorted to eating most of that here for seafood. But when it comes to sushi, I think, you know, that very traditional, just Japanese, no frills. I don't like any sauce on it. Just give me that, you know, bluefin tuna, big eye tuna. I'm happy.
Nice, nice. There's this guy on YouTube and TikTok. He'll get fish from like Costco and Safeway and stuff, and he'll explain like how to look at it, like based on where it's frozen and all this other stuff, and if it's farmed, like how safe it is to use as sushi.
Oh, really?
So maybe some, you should look into that and be able to at least enjoy some sushi even though you're landlocked.
I'll have to check out my local Costco and see if it's safe to eat it raw.
Cindy, you're going to have to add the YouTube link to the show notes.
I guess I'll add it to the show notes. I just want to be clear that this does not constitute medical advice. Please see your own doctor before eating fish from Costco raw.
Yeah, try at your own risk. Don't, you know, don't blame us if you get sick. Or Costco, because I'm sure they have a big sign that says do not consume raw.
Probably.
Oh, man. All right. Unrelated. Carmen, what's a good piece of advice you've gotten as a learner or as a teacher?
Well, I think something that a lot of people don't know about me is that I was a concert pianist in my former life. So before I went into medical school, I was super gung-ho about being a pianist, being a piano teacher, sort of going through all the formal training. I will say that I was not naturally talented or really good at the piano naturally, but I practiced a lot. And so when I talk to my residents and trainees, you know, I emphasize how important it is to practice, practice, practice. You know, as a surgeon, you really want to look at the operating room as the Olympics. That's something that one of my partners says all the time. You know, that's your big stage. You're there to perform. You're not there to practice on a patient. And I've always been told that, you know, genius is what, 99% hard work and 1% natural talent. And so it's okay if, you know, operating and being good with your hands isn't, you know, natural for you. You know, it's important to practice. Kobe Bryant, you know, the greatest of all time, used to do over 1,000 three-pointers before every season, every day, just to get better. So if Kobe Bryant did that, you know, we should really be practicing all the time. And that could be mental practice, physical practice, simulation, augmented reality practice. I think it all counts.
Oh, that's such fantastic advice. You know, when I was in the military, we were doing drills, and I was you know, we're doing some of these large simulations, these medical simulations, and one of my instructors came up to me and said, you know, when things get really tough and, you know, your adrenaline's running, like, the thing that happens is people don't rise to the occasion. They actually fall back on their training. So that's why it's important to train, to sim, to practice things. You know, here in pediatrics and in medicine, you know, we do a lot of, you know, clinical reasoning. So practicing those skill sets and things like that, that's fantastic advice. So thanks for bringing that up. Do we want to ask about your favorite book?
I mean, I'm always a fan of a favorite book, or we could even do a TV show, podcast.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Anything cool you're checking out recently?
So I've been reading The Butchering Art. Have you guys come across that book? It was actually in our book club, our residency program at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, the urology residency program, where we do a book club. And golly, they always choose some really good books for the residents to think about. And The Butchering Art was one of them. And I'm finally getting around to reading a year later, after it's been discussed in the book club. But basically, it's about Victorian era medicine. So it's back in the 1800s. It's a nonfiction book, which I like. I don't really like fiction books. And it's about Joseph Lister, you know, sort of the guy who invented antiseptic surgery, right? He's like the father of Listerine. Antiseptic surgery. Yes, Listerine, exactly. I mean, that's probably where the name came from. And it's just incredible to read accounts of how surgery was done in the past. Mortality rate was like, I don't know, 80, 90%, because they all died from infections. They didn't understand how infections worked. And Joseph Lister, being a very smart, curious man, you know, kind of just went down a rabbit hole, relied on his, you know, curiosity to figure out what was causing all these deaths, and revolutionized the field of surgery. And there were a lot of naysayers. I think one of the take-home points for me was how many people didn't believe him. They didn't believe in the power of microscope. And so for him to go against these heads, these celebrities that were surgery chairs of these big departments, and to say that how they were thinking about infections was wrong, and then proving them right. I think he operated on Queen Victoria, and that was like the turning point when she survived. I just thought that was incredible. It's such an incredible story about resilience, about believing in a cause, about that sort of pursuit, that fervent pursuit to find an answer and not just settling for, you know, what the field is telling you. Always thinking that there's got to be something to improve healthcare. I think that's just incredible. This was, you know, 1800s. So people are chopping off arms and doing all sorts of crazy things.
It's written by Lindsay Fitzharris. I used to, back when I was on Instagram, I remember following her, and she also had always tons of cool, like, medical history stuff that she would post. So, reminds me of, I don't know, have you guys ever watched the TV show The Nick?
Nope, I've heard about it.
I think it was on Cinemax. It definitely is more adult-themed TV show, but it was at the turn of the 19th, 19th to 20th century, about the surgeon played by Clive Owen. It was sort of directed by Steven Soderbergh. It's a fantastic look at, just always fantastically shot, but just really cool look at medicine at the turn of the century. So the previous turn of the century, not the recent one. So, all right. I guess I've injected too much. We probably should talk about the topic tonight, right?
Whether this is your first episode or you've been with us since day one, you know our goal has always been to share clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge in pediatric medicine. So let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day as a hospitalist, FIGS. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in FIGS scrubs. And I get it. I wear them too. They're incredibly soft, form-fitting, and durable. And it's not just us. If you've been watching a certain popular emergency room drama on TV that may or may not take place in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, yep, they're in FIGS too. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and what keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids, and kids come with messes, I love that FIGS are antimicrobial. When stuff gets on your scrubs, and it will, you just wash them and they come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine over 50 times and they still look brand new. All of that and so much more is why we've teamed up with FIGS. Now Cribsiders listeners can get 15% off. Just go to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX to get 15% off.
So let's get started with case number one. You are about to see 7-year-old Ursula for a chief complaint of, quote, peeing her pants at school. Before walking into the room, you do a quick chart review. She seems to be a healthy 7-year-old with no active diagnoses or medications listed. She's growing well along the 30th to 40th percentile for her height and weight. You can't find any history of UTIs diagnosed at your institution. You take a moment to think through what you want to do next. So just to kind of jump into questions here, without any additional history or exam findings, what is your differential diagnosis for this case?
Oh, gosh. This is a very common patient scenario that I see every time I'm in clinic. In fact, we have a whole clinic for it called Avoiding Dysfunction Clinic. And that's because daytime is just what it sounds like to me with this patient. Daytime urinary incontinence affects nearly 10 million children over the age of 6 in the United States. And it's more common in girls than boys. So I see a lot of girls in the school age bracket, at least 2 to 5 times higher risk of having something like this. And usually these parents come to us with children that are very distraught because their children are being bullied or treated differently because they smell like urine. They're wet all the time and they're being treated differently. And in fact, you know, wetting pants is rated as, I think, the number 3 most stressful life events for these school-age children. So we take these cases very seriously. We spend a lot of time sort of counseling the parents, talking with the children, and really try to figure out what's going on. Because these have some very serious long-term psychological self-esteem consequences. So listening to this prompt, which is pretty much every child that comes to my clinic, not a lot of information, you know, my first thought is common things are common. That's what I tell my trainees. And that is, this is likely avoiding dysfunction patient, specifically daytime incontinence. And it is important to differentiate the two. And I think we'll be talking a little bit about that throughout the prompt. And etiologies for daytime incontinence could be UTIs, it could be bowel dysfunction, it could be diet related, it could be behaviorally related. There could be neurodevelopmental conditions that can cause daytime incontinence. A lot of recent research has shown that. And then, of course, we can't forget neurologic etiologies, you know, issues with the spinal cord or even anatomic or structural problems with the urinary tract. So very broad, lots of etiologies for this, you know, very problematic issue.
So with such a large differential, how would you go about crafting the questions you have for your history? What are the things you want to ask the family, the patient? What do you want to know straight right off? And what red flags would you be worried about?
So, you know, I tell you that I spend a lot of time, you know, during these consults, and usually they're well over an hour. It's because the the questions themselves during the history taking, you know, just takes a long time. I think these parents come to us thinking that this would be a quick fix, magic pill, just give me something to give my child and it's going to go away. But they don't realize that usually these problems are multifaceted. It's multifactorial. So the first thing that, you know, immediately that I like to ask is, has there been any history of UTIs? Usually these parents come to us saying, well, we've gone to the pediatrician. They've checked our urine a lot of times, thinking that the leakage is from, you know, urinary tract infection. We've taken a lot of different antibiotics, doc, and I don't know what works and what doesn't. I just have been told that, you know, there's been a lot of UTIs. And so the first thing is educating the parents and understanding what the symptoms are and what they've been using to treat those symptoms. I have a really long discussion about how they collect the urine, what constitutes as a true UTI, and are the symptoms usually abdominal pain or is it burning with urination? And then I spend a lot of time talking about dietary habits. What do they like to eat? What do they like to drink? And then how often do they pee? How often do they go to the bathroom to poop? And then once we move past that, I do a very thorough exam. Every patient that comes into the office gets an abdominal and genital exam. I tell them when you come to the urologist, it's important that someone looks down there because oftentimes pediatricians are trying to, you know, get to the next patient and may not be looking what's going on in the underwear. And so I spend a lot of time explaining the importance of a full genital exam. What I do is a very gentle visual exam if it's a girl, first looking at to see if there's any inflamed or red labia that could suggest that there's been issues with urine pooling, skin breakdown. I also look gently inside the vaginal opening and see if I see any urine trapped in there. And I also look at the back and kind of take a look and see if there's any sacral dimples, abnormalities to the gluteal cleft that might point to a neurologic deficit. And then lastly, but very importantly, I do watch and see if there's any weakness to their legs. And so I'd ask if they've been complaining about being, you know, tired, not being able to finish a basketball game. I have them walk up and down the hallway, check their gait, all of that to really try to rule out a neurologic component.
You know, you were saying that you look to see if the sacral dimple and things like that. Like, so it sounds like even at age 7, people, this is something that possibly could be missed and that could be picked up for the first time from their incontinence symptoms. Is that what you're telling me?
Oh, absolutely. You know, oftentimes parents will be sent or patients will be sent to different subspecialists for various symptoms that all actually point to a neurologic etiology. It could be that they went to see sports medicine or orthopedics for some weakness in their legs and they're being worked up by physical therapy. And then a few months later, they started developing issues with their bladder and bowel and they come to see me. And so if there isn't someone who can try to piece together all of the pieces of the puzzle, you may think they're completely unrelated, but in fact, it could all point to some issue with a spinal cord, like a tethered cord, in which case the answer isn't physical therapy or medications to treat the incontinence. It's really spinal surgery.
And then, okay, so you've done your history, you've done your physical. Anything you would want to ask about the patient's past medical history, family history? You mentioned the recurrent UTI. Anything else that maybe we should be looking for?
I spend a good amount of time asking about prenatal history also. I'd like to know if there are any concerns with urine production or hydronephrosis that could suggest a urinary tract anomaly. I always ask about medications because recent medications can cause issues with incontinence or urinary retention. And then I always ask about sort of social stressors or changes. That could be a new school, trauma, changes to family dynamics that, you know, families might not realize could play a part in incontinence. And then lastly, I do always ask about family history of vesico-ureteral reflux, especially if the child complains about febrile UTIs and frequent febrile UTIs to the point where they're getting 2 to 3 in a 6-month period. We know that there's increased risk of reflux if, for instance, the patient has a sibling with reflux. That risk goes up to 25 to 30%. And then if a parent gives me a history of, oh, I've been told that I had reflux, it's self-resolved, that risk goes up to 70% that my patient could have reflux also.
I think that's a really helpful pearl because I think in pediatrics, we are not always as comprehensive with taking a family history as we might be. And it's important to recognize that it's not just the cardio pulmonary risks that run in families, but also some of these other parts of the body.
Yes. Yes, I always, you know, I tell my trainees and my patients that I have a very small focus of the body, but I ask a lot of questions to that because there are some sort of genetic or hereditary components to some of the things we talk about today. And it can help educate the parents about, you know, sort of timeline, resolution, all that good stuff that they care about.
Sydney, you want to take us to kind of part two? I think we've been teasing history and physical. If we can give out some history and physical, then maybe we can talk a little bit more about getting into that differential diagnosis.
Absolutely. Okay, so you do your history and physical, and you learn that for the past few months, she sometimes doesn't realize that she needs to pee until it's too late. This has happened at home, but mostly at school. She denies any pain with urinating. Her stools are typically Bristol type 1 or 2. She's a fairly picky eater and avoids fruits and vegetables except when she can't tell they're there. There is no personal or family history of genitourinary anomaly. She has normal sensation, no lower extremity weakness or gait abnormalities on exam. Her abdominal and genitourinary exams are normal other than mild abdominal fullness. Her dad does mention that her grandmother recently passed away.
Wow, I took a really good history and physical. That was slam dunk.
I know. Sydney, you're saying we don't really take one.
I mean, wow, that was great.
Yeah, if only we always had time to do right. that. All right, so let's kind of jump into next steps. I think a lot of times my next question is like, okay, what studies am I going to do? So what labs/urine studies would you want to do for her in this case?
Yes. Well, I usually start off with just a urinalysis. In our office, we just do a urine dip because maybe this is just some undiagnosed UTI that never got treated, in which case that's a really easy answer. We treat the UTI, you know, based on her urine culture and then reevaluate her symptoms. I do counsel parents that, you know, a urine dipstick is very generic and nonspecific. And that just because we get a positive urine dip does not correlate necessarily with a positive urine culture. And just because we have a positive urine culture doesn't necessarily mean it's a positive UTI, right? And so it really requires a positive UA, a positive urine culture in the setting of symptoms, which incontinence is considered a symptom, which would then allow us to treat. So I do counsel very carefully about when we do and do not treat for UTIs. And then because of sort of everything that, you know, my wonderful history and physical had revealed, I usually do get a renal ultrasound to just make sure that the kidneys and the bladder look okay. I tell parents that 8 or 9 out of 10 times I don't find anything, but we don't want to miss potentially, you know, a urinary tract anomaly, some hydronephrosis that could explain something else going on.
So you said something a little earlier quickly that you counsel parents on when and when you do not treat UTIs. Can you explain that a little more and maybe even use the type of language you would normally would when talking to parents about that?
So it is important for us to, first of all, make sure that every UTI gets treated appropriately because we don't want to over-treat. And we certainly want to make sure that we treat the right bug. And so there are multiple components to help us get there. The first and probably one of the most important things that I talk to parents is urine collection method. When there's concern for a UTI, it is important that we try to obtain as sterile as possible sample. And so oftentimes, whether you go to urgent care, you know, or, you know, the drive-by nurse visit with the pediatrician, they give you a hat to pee into, which is not necessarily sterile. And parents will tell me, well, she doesn't really want to pee in a cup. It's kind of weird. She's not comfortable with it. And I have to emphasize, well, it is important that we try to get as sterile a sample as possible because we do want to make sure that the bacteria that's growing in the sample is the actual bacteria in the bladder from the urine and not from the surface, for instance, of the hat. Or, you know, if you stick a bag onto the genitalia to pee into the bag, it's going to collect bacteria from the skin. And now we're treating all sorts of bacteria that we don't really know if it's actual bacteria in the bladder. That's problem number one. Problem number two is there are a lot of things that children, particularly school-age girls, that will complain, but not necessarily UTI symptoms. Oh, it dirt burns down below. Oh, it kind of hurts down below. My tummy kind of hurts. But in fact, they're not actually UTI symptoms. They point to constipation symptoms. And so if we only treat symptoms but don't have a true culture to point towards the problem, not only are we not treating bacteria, now we're treating a whole different problem. And over-treating, again, you know, has a lot of issues. The bacteria can develop resistance. It can mess with the natural flora in the environment. It's just no bueno. And so I get really angry actually sometimes when I get the history that the parents are you know, just giving back antibiotics to their child without understanding the importance of getting urine culture. And, you know, I'll have parents come to me say, oh my gosh, it's so much work. Every time we have to drive by the pediatrician and drop off the urine sample, and you're telling me that the urine's only good within an hour of collection. That means I can't just collect it in the morning and then drop it off in the afternoon. It's such a burden. Can you just give me a standing order at the pharmacy and just let me treat the child, you know, with you know, Bactrim or whatever. She's done well with it before. And I really can't, you know, recommend that to anybody because, again, it just perpetuates this problem as an education problem. And it's an opportunity to discuss what else could be going on with this child that may not be related to UTIs.
So we've been talking a little bit about UTI, and I actually have, I feel like, an important question to bring up. Why is UTI giving the 7-year-old incontinence?
Great question. So that is multifaceted, also multifactorial. But really, the easiest way to remember to know this, or the way that I tell parents, is that the inflammation to the lining of the inside of the bladder, to the mucosa of the bladder, gets the bladder really angry and basically causes bladder overactivity or detrusor overactivity. And it will cause urine leakage. That's problem number one. Problem number two is if this patient also has constipation, doesn't void very frequently, and now there's inflammation on top of that, essentially, the nerves going to the bladder are on fire. And it's important to kind of understand how constipation, UTIs, flora in the environment, and bladder overactivity works. And so the way that I explain this to parents is that the bladder functions like a balloon, and it descends and fills as urine gets collected, and then it deflates and empties whenever we go to the bathroom to pee. Now, the rectum and the colon sit right behind the bladder. And so if a patient is constipated, it gets filled with hard boulders of poop that push on the bladder, push on your balloon, right? And so it causes issues with the balloon being able to fill and empty appropriately. So this can lead to overactivity of the bladder muscle, which then shows up as urinary incontinence. Now you throw in UTI on top of that. Man, that bladder is just having a heyday. I mean, it's inflamed, it's angry, it's trying to fight this infection, it's collecting debris from the bacteria because you're not emptying well. And so it's just constantly spasming and trying to relax. Now, another sort of challenge in these girls with incontinence, okay, the damp underwear and potentially, you know, improper wiping kind of fits into this too. But the damp underwear, the damp environment leads to bacterial overgrowth and colonization in this perineal region. Things are already kind of moist in there. And so that moist environment is the perfect sort of environment for bacteria to grow and then migrate and crawl up the urethra and proliferate in the bladder. And so it's really a very vicious cycle. You've got bladder overactivity that leads to a lot of pelvic floor dysfunction. The infection is making it worse, more pelvic floor dysfunction. That pelvic floor dysfunction then can cause issues with bowel movements and constipation. And it's just literally the arrows are just pointing at each other. It's like that meme with the Spider-Man. It's like pointing at each other. Who's the cause here? That's the perfect picture for this.
I literally am going to picture that every single time that I deal with a family with urinary incontinence. And honestly, maybe it'll help them understand. They'll be like, the damp underwear is pointing at the bladder. Inflammation is pointing at the constipation. Anyway.
Exactly.
Recognizing that there are all of these factors that could be at play, I wanted to jump back to when you mentioned that you would probably do an ultrasound on this patient. I am not in the habit of routinely ordering ultrasounds without a history of recurrent UTI. And so I'm curious, is that something that you would do regardless of the history? Is that kind of like a best practice in general for a kid with incontinence in primary care? Is it reasonable to say, let's do a trial of XYZ intervention and then see if it improves before jumping to it? Or do you feel like ruling out that pathology is important to do regardless?
Yeah, that's a great question. I should probably start off at the very beginning to say that, you know, voiding dysfunction or dysfunctional voiding, incontinence, most of this is just essentially expert opinion, anecdotal evidence, you know, sort of best practice types of guidelines. There's not a lot of true evidence-based guidelines, as you can imagine. It's hard to do large head-to-head trials for this, right? And so most of this is just a large group of pediatric urologists, behavioral therapists, pediatricians, you know, coming together and saying, this is what we think we should do. And for the most part, it works really well, but there are obviously some that don't fit that mold perfectly. And that's what the renal ultrasound is for. Usually by the time the patient comes to my clinic, the pediatrician has tried some of these things, either because they've listened to this podcast or they heard, you know, my lecture at AAP, those kinds of things. Or, you know, they were very motivated and looked up, you know, the guidelines for this. But they have tried some behavioral therapies. And, you know, the parents are just pulling their hair out and the pediatrician's like, please go to the specialist. And so I always get a little bit, there's always a small part of me where I don't want to miss a congenital anomaly of the urinary tract that could explain this. Specifically an ectopic ureter, meaning the ureter inserting ectopically or abnormally in a location where it shouldn't, right? And so the most common location for girls is really the vagina. And have I seen this? Absolutely, in a few cases where the parents have tried everything, they've done all of the workup, she's completely cleaned out, and, you know, they're just like, there's got to be something going on. But usually the history suggests that there has never been a period of dryness. And that's important to emphasize, I think. Usually these girls come to us saying, oh, they were toilet trained by age 2. And there were 3 years, 3 really good years where she was in underwear, completely dry, no issues. And then they get to school, bam. Then, you know, all of a sudden we have all these issues with urinary incontinence during school time. Then I would be a little bit less, you know, worried about some underlying congenital condition. If the parents come to me saying, we've never been able to toilet train this child, and it's now 9, 10, 11 years old, she's always damp, she's always in pads, we're now in pull-ups, we're now in the pens, something else must be going on. We've done all of the poop stuff, all the behavioral stuff, the time voiding. Then, you know, I really do want to investigate. And so those are the patients where I have a pretty high suspicion of at least getting an ultrasound. And it's easy. It's just jelly on the belly. It's non-invasive. It's not specific, but it's also no radiation, right? So the risk is extremely low. At the most, it's some wasted time in the radiology department.
So I just wanted to summarize a little bit before we kind of get into your initial recommendations or management trials. You know, you say all these pediatricians have tried, you know, that type of thing. We definitely want to talk about that. But before we do, we just kind of got talking about labs and studies, and we kind of mentioned your analysis went down the UTI pathway. We also talked about renal bladder ultrasound, looking for an ectopic ureter, looking for congenital anomaly, even, you know, vesicular ureter reflux, despite whether they've had UTIs in the past. Are there any other testing that you would automatically get off the bat before we jump into initial recommendations?
Generally not. But now you asked, maybe I should think.
No, not at all. Not in the slightest. That's not the point. I was just kind of bringing us back just to make sure, because we just started talking about UTI for a bit. I wanted to make sure that we didn't forget something else that you wanted to bring up at that time. But no, we definitely don't need to do it. We are love to do, you know, evidence-based, you know, ethics-based, all the types of things, type of medicine. And so if those are what you recommend to begin with, then we will wonderfully start with there. And so we can just move on to the next thing. So this patient comes to you. It's relatively classic. You know, what's the first thing you do when you give recommendations to the parents about what we can do for this patient?
So like the very first line I tell these parents is, don't expect this to get fixed quickly. And again, there's no magic pill. The first line is really urotherapy, which is cognitive behavioral psychotherapy. All right. It's based on educating the parents, educating the patient, a lot of lifestyle changes, better toileting habits. For girls, that really specifically means spreading your legs and making sure that you're emptying all the way and that there's no urine trapping in the vagina. And then use of fiber or laxatives for good bowel movements. And then making sure, especially if the incontinence is worse at school, having good voiding habits that are timed and double voiding. And so I tell parents, you know, we usually, when they leave our clinic, we give them a pamphlet about, you know, time voiding, double voiding, having a potentially a little watch that beeps every 2 to 3 hours to remind a child to go to the bathroom, giving them a slip for school for bathroom privileges, and also, you know, free access to water bottles. I don't know how schools are in your region, but our schools are very particular about stuff like that. And they don't really always allow children to have a water bottle. So oftentimes these children are very dehydrated or they don't drink the right things because they're, you know, avoiding to go to the bathroom. And then they're holding their urine because they don't have bathroom privileges and it makes incontinence worse. And so all of those combined have shown at least, you know, 40-50% significant improvement within several weeks. But it could take up to several months before we can see some measurable improvement. And then, you know, I usually bring them back to my clinic in about 3 to 6 months' time, kind of reevaluate symptoms. I also ask them to keep a voiding diary because kids will forget and parents forget. They get busy, right? And they said, I don't know. I think they've been peeing a few times a day. And then you ask them to actually document how many times and they see, oh, goodness, she's only gone to the bathroom once in the morning and only once before bedtime. So really just twice in a day. And that's kind of like an aha moment for them, too. So I do have them keep a voiding diary. And within the voiding diary, also a bowel movement diary, of course, all goes on the same page. How many bowel movements are we having? The Bristol score of those, just keeping track of all that. If all that fails and the parents have been extremely adherent to therapy, then really the next line therapy could be consideration for medication to relax the bladder, like the anticholinergics. But I do tell parents that a big side effect of anticholinergics is constipation. And so if we don't have constipation under control, I'm very hesitant to put them on these medications. And then pelvic floor therapy, biofeedback, all that to help retrain the pelvic floor. Even neuromodulation have been shown to potentially work in this patient group. But, you know, we're getting more and more and more invasive at that point.
Wow. I feel like that was a lot of really important information. I would love to like piece out some of those different things and just get some very quick logistical advice. So step one, for timed voiding, is that literally like every 2 to 3 hours when the buzzer goes off, you go to the bathroom? Is there anything more to it?
Yes. No. Time voiding is exactly that. Simple, but very, very effective. In this particular prompt, it sounds like the incontinence happens because the child can't reach the bathroom in time and have been holding for a long time. So that kind of suggests to me that the bladder is really full. And it's so full that the bladder now spasms and becomes overactive. And that's where the incontinence happens, if I were to guess what's going on. And so time voiding helps retrain the bladder. If the bladder is a balloon and, you know, over time, it just gets more and more stressed, the muscles in the bladder can fail over time and become fibrosed, you know, scarred. And now we're not dealing with a balloon. We're basically dealing with a metal block where it is not compliant at all. Then we go into bladder failure. And so not that I like to scare my parents, but, you know, there are a few select patients who unfortunately go down that pathway where they are no longer able to have reasonable control of their bladder because the muscles have failed. And so time voiding works great because it retrains the bladder. Now, double voiding works great specifically for children who get very distracted and want to get back to their games or playing outside because it makes them actually take the time at the toilet. And so I ask them to count to 10 or count to 20 and at a reasonable rate. Don't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, which, as we all know, a lot of school-age children will do. And so I ask them to count to 10 or 20 and then, you know, have them try to pee and empty all the way. especially for the patients where there's already potentially some defunctioning of their bladder where they can't really actually empty all the way anymore. This will help them empty as much as possible before they go back to their activity.
Okay. Thank you. Awesome. And then for constipation, do we need to do a full bowel clean out? Is it, and we have a whole constipation episode. You don't have to recap the full management of constipation in, you know, 2 minutes.
Okay, good.
Are we doing a clean out? Are we just doing kind of the general maintenance management? Does it depend on the degree of severity, et cetera, et cetera?
So, you know, there are GI people who manage constipation so much better, but when they come to my clinic, they usually haven't seen GI yet or don't really need a full GI consult. You asked earlier about a renal bladder ultrasound and, you know, should we get that for everybody? And I say, not really. But when I do get them, I actually do take a look and see if I can see poop in the rectum behind the bladder. You can see it actually deforming the contour of the bladder. And that is one of those things where I pull it up in my office and show parents and go, do you see these kind of lumps? That's poop. And you see how it's not a nice oblong or round shape of the bladder because the poop is pushing on it. And that's really when they kind of get the full picture. And in patients and parents who are still ambivalent about constipation, because they'll often come to you and say, my child poops every day. What do you mean he's constipated or she's constipated? I will get an x-ray in those rare circumstances to show them that colon or the intestine is completely filled with poop. And so those are little tools in my toolbox where I may have a parent that's particularly difficult to convince to show them that constipation is really a big culprit here. In my practice, I do like to do a full clean out because I explain constipation like the Pez candy. You get one off, you know, the top, and then you still have a whole line of Pez candy behind it. And of course, the children are like, what are Pez candies? They sound delicious. And then the parents are like, oh my goodness, I know exactly what you're talking about. I had one that had, you know, Homer Simpson on it or whatever, you know, all of the characters. But, you know, it's a very powerful imagery, right? To imagine, okay, they could be pooping every day, but they're not clearing the entire column. And so I do like to have them start with a clean slate. Miralax clean out, in my opinion, works great. And then once they're completely cleaned out, then start on maintenance therapy for a couple months until they're able to prove that they can remain cleaned out and having, you know, regular bowel movements. And then we do a trial of taking them off of the therapy to see how they do.
And I have actually two more logistical questions to this before we even move on to the medication portion. As for the double voids, how do you tell a 7-year-old to double void?
So this is several fold. You know, you can have them sing happy birthday or, you know, sing any song that they like, you know, Baby Shark, or just count to 10 or 20 before coming back. This requires a lot of monitoring at the beginning by the parent, to be honest, because they may pretend to do it and then they don't do it. But, you know, it is important to emphasize these important habits early on and get it down as a routine. Then they don't really have to do it as often, particularly if for a couple months they've done it and they're like, the second time I pee, really nothing comes out. Then I'm like, okay, it sounds like you're emptying to completion the first go around. But what I get worried about with these children is that they will empty just enough to not get that urge anymore. So we're going from a tank of 100% down to a tank of 50%, for instance. And now they're like, oh, I don't have that urge anymore. I want to get back to playing my Xbox. They run over, and now you're starting not from 0%, you're starting from 50%, right? And so going from 50% to 100% takes a very short amount of time. And now they're having issues with urgency, frequency, and potentially incontinence if they're ignoring those signals from the brain to go to the bathroom.
Awesome. And then my second question about those pieces that you put down as your first line that would treat roughly 50 to 60% of the patients, you kind of mentioned almost a urologic CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy type piece. Do you think people know of that if I like refer someone to a psychologist, or is that someone who I should probably refer to urology clinic and then you have someone behaviorally associated with your group usually?
So pelvic floor retraining or pelvic floor therapy, which I think is really what you're asking here, is becoming more and more important, but not as widespread yet. Specifically, physical therapists that focus on pelvic floor training in children. I think we hear a lot about it in adults, particularly adult women, you know, after childbirth and whatnot. But in children, it's still uncommon. And so mostly the pelvic floor retraining or biofeedback is done through a urologic clinic. My recommendation would be to refer to a urologist. We usually have a list of physical therapists who would be comfortable with dealing with pelvic floor retraining. And then also a lot of nurse practitioners are trained to do biofeedback. But these are specific games because, as you can imagine, trying to teach your child, okay, now try to relax. And then they're like, when am I relaxing? And, you know, they don't really know. And so biofeedback for children are actually games. You know, on top of a toilet. We put little electrodes, you know, on the muscles, on the outside, on the skin, of course, there's skin electrodes. And then, you know, we show them, okay, now you got to squeeze. And then you can see the little cat jumping over. Okay, you got to squeeze for 10 seconds. And then you can see the cat jumping over a big log. You know, those are games that are, you know, on a level that children can understand. And then over time, they're like, okay, so when this person's telling me to squeeze this area, that's what this means. And when someone tells me to relax this area, that's what that means. It has to be at a level that children can understand, which can sometimes be difficult.
Yeah. And you had said pelvic floor therapy more. I think you would kind of mention almost like a third line piece down. Maybe I missed what you said initially. I thought there was some behavioral component that you had mentioned off the bat.
Yes.
That's more I was curious about as far as how what we do as primary care doctors to kind of do that piece.
Yeah. So behavioral. So that's a great question. When I say sort of like behavioral modification through CBT, what I really mean is the time voiding, the double voiding, which, you know, also wraps into like being more cognitively aware of when you need to go to the bathroom. So that's one. The other is, of course, from a behavioral modification, toileting, you know, making sure you're spreading your legs, proper hygiene, potentially using a potty stool when you're, you know, pooping, which really helps. And then I always kind of loop into a dietary component when I talk about behavioral modification, because I think that is the one thing that stands out a lot, at least in my clinic here in Alabama. You know, a lot of my children drink a lot of sweet tea. And there's a lot of caffeine in it. And caffeine is known to be a significant bladder irritant, not just for adults, but really for children. And so I'll often ask, well, what does this child like to drink? And they're like, oh, the usual, you know, water, sweet tea. And then the child's like, I really love sweet tea. That's all I drink. And, you know, it's like, aha. Well, you know, that's an easy behavioral modification where we can kind of titrate the child off of any caffeinated drinks and see how they do. And oftentimes that's really the only culprit.
Awesome. Yeah, we actually haven't talked about diet too much. You kind of mentioned it in the beginning, mostly around picky eating and things like that. It sounds like, you know, we always think of the diet actually affecting the constipation component and how that's leading to these issues. It sounds like caffeine is something that will affect the bladder directly. Is there any other diet pieces that we should know of that would affect the bladder directly? And it's okay to say no.
No, there actually is. Again, this is not fully evidence-based. You know, these are all smaller studies, right? But I will say that the usual things that we all counsel parents and patients on, not just caffeine, is red and yellow dye. Have been shown in multiple studies to be very irritating for the bladder. So there's a lot of stuff with red dye, you know, in our drinks, Kool-Aid, pasta sauce, pizza sauce, all of that has, you know, ketchup, all of that has red dye in it. And then we talked about caffeine. There's also spicy foods and acidic foods. Of course, some of this is in moderation. If the child's saying, I only eat this once a week, that's not a big component. But if you're eating Takis, where you've got red dye and it's super spicy, I do not understand the lore of Takis, but children seem to really love it. And almost every child that comes to my clinic eats Takis. And so I tell them that they have to cut it out because it really is very bad for them.
Yeah, that seems like good advice regardless.
Yes, exactly.
All right. So, you know, we've gone back, we've talked about a lot of these logistics, and, you know, it sounds like after a lot of this is actually first line. And then you started saying that maybe the next line you might start talking about medications, and you brought up anticholinergics. Can you go into that a little deeper? Which anticholinergics are you talking about, and how would we consider dosing them? Or should the pediatrician be doing this and not, or maybe not doing this, and this should be more in the realm of what the urologist does?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I've seen it on both ends where the pediatrician has tried all of the behavioral stuff, dietary stuff, and was like, okay, I can't do this. Let's send you to a urologist. And then I say, okay, it looks like you've done really well. Bowels look really clean. It looks like you're adherent to, you know, all of the urinary stuff. So we just start you on a medicine. And then I've also had pediatricians who feel very, very comfortable and say, I'm just going to start you on a medicine. I think either is fine, to be honest. The medications that we give to children are, you know, for in this kind of circumstance are usually pretty low in side effects. And so I don't necessarily think that you need a urologic consultation for it. With that said, though, if you've done kind of a lot of the workup and things are just not adding up, especially if they're not quite responding to medications, that really is when you should just send them to a urologist to figure out what's going on. For overactive bladder, specifically, I say that because there are a lot of things that can cause incontinence, right? It could be a bladder being too active or a bladder being underactive, and that could cause your urine issues too. So it's very important to kind of figure out which one it is. And earlier you asked, now that I'm thinking about it, what other studies you would get. I would get one more thing in my office, and that's a PVR, a post-void residual, exactly for this reason. Because sometimes it's hard to tell, well, is this person leaking because their bladder is just spasming? In which case, that's something that medication can help, right? But is this person leaking because their bladder has become so dysfunctional that it can't even squeeze? And so this child never empties all the way. And now we're dealing with a full tank all the time. And the path of least resistance is out the urethra. And in which case, medication is really not the right answer at all. And it can make urinary retention worse. So let's stick with scenario number one, which is overactive bladder. You've confirmed that they can empty all the way. You've done a PVR and it shows that it's, you know, less than, it's an appropriate amount, okay? And they pretty much empty all the way. The first medication that I usually give is oxybutynin. Are we allowed to use generic medication names? We are.
Generic is okay. Fantastic.
Okay, great. Oxybutynin is a medicine that I use in as young as 1 year olds. And so they're really safe medicine, but there are several notable side effects that I do tell parents. That's constipation. Obviously, if the patient we talked about this has, you know, constipation, we don't want to give a medicine that can make it worse. And so I do tell parents, hey, you know, if we start this medicine, just keep an eye on their poops. Go back to the voiding poop diary, check out the Bristol score, make sure that if they're being backed up, restart that Miralax. The other is dry mouth, which is not necessarily a bad thing if a child doesn't drink very much and may actually encourage more drinking. And then, you know, feeling very flushed and warm and red. You know, and if any of these symptoms becomes too bothersome, we'll have to stop the medicine. But it's a medicine that can easily titrate. It can come in liquid. It can come in pill form. You can titrate based on symptoms. I usually start at the lowest amount. If it's really a child less than basically 5 years old, you know, I do a little bit of weight base, which is about 0.1 mgs per kg, 2 to 3 times a day. And then pretty much after five years old, I do about 5 milligrams, 2 to 3 times a day and see how they do.
And I actually have a question about the PVRs, because the one thing I don't want to do is take a distended bladder and make it more distended by adding an anticholinergic. I want to know what essentially the maximum PVR should be that's considered normal for a bladder, for depending on the age or kilo.
Great question. This is very testable, I think. I don't know in pediatrics, but I know it is in urology. So you're really asking about estimated bladder capacity.
Yes. Right? Yes, I am.
and it is partly age-based and partly weight-based. So the general good rule is for any child really under the age of 2, I do weight in kilograms times 7. So if you have an 8-kilogram child, your expected bladder capacity should be around 50 to 60. Okay. Now, once you're past the age of 2, then we switch to a different formula. We do age plus 2, whatever that is, times 30. So in this case, this 8-year-old child, it would be 8 plus 2, which is 10, times 30, which is 300 cc's. So there's no clear-cut rule when I would be, you know, kind of nervous about starting medication. Meaning, if I have a PVR of, for instance, 30 to 50 cc's, it tells me that it's pretty well emptied. But if in this child, okay, even after voiding and double voiding, you know, and making sure that she's actually in the toilet voiding, her PVR is 200, 250. That would make me a little bit nervous starting any medication. We really got to work on figuring out, hey, is she really doing all of the things? And then kind of taking a look at, oh my goodness, is she someone who, where the muscle has decompensated enough where, you know, the answer is really not actually medication and potentially, you know, clean intermittent catheterization or whatever it is.
Awesome. I'm just going to summarize for a second just to see if we kind of talked a lot about daytime incontinence. We talked about all these things. I'm going to try to summarize real fast. You tell me if it is, and then we can hopefully move on to our next topic. So it sounds like for the kid who's coming in, you'd probably start with a UA and renal bladder ultrasound and a PVR, which we added to this piece, is very important. As far as treatment goes, we talk about double voiding, time voiding, constipation, which includes a clean out. As we move to the second line, we will, you know, possibly medicines, anticholinergics, only if we have an overactive bladder, not if we have a completely full bladder, which detrusion muscles aren't working. And then we can talk about pelvic floor biofeedback after that. It sounds like this stuff will take a long time to get better, and you'll see these patients in 3 to 6 months. And hopefully we as pediatricians will support them all the way through.
Perfect.
Am I missing anything big? Otherwise, everyone else, check out the show notes.
No, I think that's perfect. One thing that I get often asked from pediatricians is the role of antibiotic prophylaxis. Would it be okay if we take 1 minute to kind of discuss that?
Yes, please.
Because I get a lot of phone calls when I'm on call about, oh, should I put this child on prophylaxis? Should I not? You know, particularly in the school age patient, right? I think, you know, in a newborn where they may have some urinary tract anomaly, most of us feel better if we throw some amoxicillin or something, at least temporarily until I get to see them. But I think I get a lot of phone calls, particularly about a patient who has what a pediatrician would think is recurrent UTIs. Afebrile, specifically recurrent UTIs, but it could be febrile, and we can talk about that too. In my book, and I think in most guidelines, really, we like to define recurrent UTIs as 2 to 3 in about a 6 month period. And again, they have to follow all of the previous things I talked about, right? Positive UA, symptoms, and has to be culture positive. And so, assuming that they are true UTIs, and they're recurrent, 2 to 3 in a 6 month period, I don't think it's unreasonable to put this child on antibiotic prophylaxis. And it has to be case by case. But oftentimes these parents come to me super frustrated and, you know, they're working on the bladder bowel dysfunction stuff. They're doing the poops, they're doing the time voiding, but they just can't seem to kick the UTIs. And so then I'll trial them for about 3 to 6 months. There are a lot of new evidence coming out that sort of describe this idea of colonization in the bladder, where children, when they're not having an acute episode, will just have little pockets of bacteria, almost like, you know, like a little sleeper cell of bacteria in the lining of the bacteria where it doesn't do anything. But the bladder wall is colonized. And for whatever reason, a depressed immune system, stressors in life, they begin to proliferate and then cause an infection. And so really, I tell parents that, you know, long-term prophylaxis is never a good idea, but a trial of 3 to 6 months, I think, is reasonable to allow for the system to reset while the family works on all of the bladder bowel stuff. And I do have some favorites. I don't know if it's appropriate to talk about them, but I'm going to throw it in anyway, and you can cut it out if you like. But, you know, I do have some favorite antibiotics. My typical first line go-to is macrodantan because it works really well in the urinary tract, specifically at the level of the bladder. It's very gentle. It doesn't really kind of wipe out all of the other flora, in my opinion. And it can comes in a capsule where you can open up, dump out the powder, and mix it in, you know, applesauce or whatever. It's very easily administered. There's no taste. It's cheap. And it works remarkably well for the majority of uropathogens. So macrodan is a favorite of mine. I typically do 2 to 2.5 mix per kg once a day. The other one that I like to do if they can't get macrodan or can't tolerate it is Bactrim. I think Bactrim is also safe. I would check with your antibiogram, you know, for your areas. A lot of places have highly, you know, Bactrim-resistant bacteria. Then in that case, it's probably not a great idea. But for prophylactic purposes, Bactrim is also a potentially good prophylactic antibiotic.
And to be clear to our listeners, Macrodan is the special, like the
formulation,
the crystalline version of nitrofurantoin, right?
Sorry, yes, nitrofurantoin, yes.
And Bactrim is also known as trimethoprim sulfa.
All right, covered all our CME bases at that moment.
Woo, thank you for that save.
All right, so we're just going to kind of wrap that piece up as our first case. And Sydney, let's get into our second case. Let's be honest, keeping up with PEDS literature is hard. Over a million new articles hit PubMed every year, and only a handful really change how we care for kids. But if you missed a few articles that matter, it means missing out on better care for your patients. That's why we're into JournalFeed. JournalFeed.org is written by practicing pediatricians who scan the literature and send you quick, high-yield summaries of the most important PEDS and primary care articles right to your inbox every weekday. Each summary gives you the bottom line up front, the quote spoon feed, plus a super short practical summary. You'll get smarter in just 2 to 3 minutes a day. It's fast, it's easy, and honestly, it's fun. And you can even earn CME credit. So, Cribsiders listeners, try Journal Feed free for 7 days and get 20% off your first year with code CRIB25 at journalfeed.org/Cribsiders. That's journalfeed.org/Cribsiders, code CRIB25.
All right, so here's our second case from Cashlight Children's. You are seeing 8-year-old Nathan for a well visit. At the visit, one of the parents pulls you aside to tell you that he still wets the bed sometimes, and they're wondering if they can do anything to help him. He has dry spells, but never more than 1 to 2 weeks at a time. There have been no daytime incontinence episodes since he was potty trained at age 3. They are particularly concerned because he really wants to go to his friend's upcoming birthday party, but is nervous that if he goes to the sleepover, he'll accidentally wet his sleeping bag. So, when it comes to bedwetting, what even is normal? And at what point should parents or should we consider intervening?
Oh, okay. That's a very loaded question. And it's also, you know, the number one question that I think parents ask me, you know, what's wrong with my child? There must be something going on. And so I like to usually give parents some statistics and then kind of bring it all together for them. It's important to sort of first define what bedwetting is, or nocturnal enuresis. It's really a child older than 5 years old, okay, with episodes of incontinence during sleep. And then it's also, you know, when I'm thinking about bedwetting in these children, is it primary or is it secondary? Because that can help you decide how to treat these patients and how to counsel them. So primary enuresis really specifically refers to a child who's never really been dry for greater than 6 months, okay? Whereas secondary enuresis is exactly what you think. They've previously been dry for greater than 6 months, and then something happened where they became wet again. And that distinction is important because secondary enuresis is actually a lot harder to treat than primary enuresis. It's usually caused by, you know, a recent stressful event, or it could be an organic cause like spinal cord or neurologic injuries, a new diagnosis of diabetes or sleep apnea, or it could be a psychological cause like behavioral disorders. And so secondary enuresis is a bit more challenging to address than primary. And then we kind of talk about statistics, because I think parents feel a little bit reassured when they hear that their child's not the only child with this. You know, they see their friends with their children who are doing sleepovers and camps and summer school, and they're doing just fine. And then their child has issues with wetting the bed every night. So really, the prevalence of enuresis at about age 5 is 15%, and that goes down to about 5% for 10-year-olds. So every year past 5, the rate goes down by about 15%. Once that child reaches teenage, young adult age, that prevalence really drops down to 1%. Now, bedwetting is more common in boys. And we do know that bedwetting can run in the family. So I do really take a very careful history asking, when did older brother, you know, finish toilet training and, you know, finally got dry at nighttime? What about uncles, cousins? And more often than not, you'll find that there was someone in the family, usually grandma chimes in here. There's someone in the family that says, oh, goodness, yes, you know, Johnny over there, his cousin didn't finish, you know, didn't get rid of his bedwetting until they were 16. Then you can kind of reset the bar, in my opinion. And you can say, well, there was someone in the family who had issues with bedwetting up until teenage age. There's a possibility that this may continue to be a problem up until then. Not the best answer, but at least it resets expectations, which is extremely important for bedwetting.
Yes, we do see bedwetting very commonly in my primary care, my pediatric population. And obviously we're seeing decrease incidence as they're getting older. But even at some of the younger ages, like, are there any specific red flags or symptoms we really should be looking out for that we don't miss without just saying, oh, you know, it's bedwetting, you know, dad or older brother stopped around this age and just set those expectations? Like, are there other things we need to worry about that we're missing, that we might miss, I should say?
Yeah, that's a great question. I counsel bedwetting very similarly as voiding dysfunction. And so it is, you know, I probably should have mentioned that early in the earlier piece. You know, there's also monosymptomatic and non-monosymptomatic night wetting. What I mean by that is this only bedwetting, or are these patients also having issues with daytime stuff? And oftentimes parents don't realize that the child is withholding during the day or having issues with incontinence or urgency, frequency, and those symptoms actually can manifest as enuresis. And so I spent a good amount of time talking about daytime stuff as much as I am talking about nighttime wetting. And so while it's not a red flag, it is an very important piece of the conversation with these parents. And so once, you know, we can actually diagnose this patient saying there's only nighttime stuff, there really isn't any daytime stuff at all. They poop well, they drink well, they do all the right things. These patients don't usually get a lot of workup in my office, meaning I'm not really getting the UA, I'm not getting an ultrasound. And again, this is very specifically for monosymptomatic nocturnal enuresis, right? And so then we kind of go into a sort of discussion of how do these patients get treated? What are we expecting to come out of this? And really the first thing is I tell parents that there's, again, no really quick fix. It's a little bit better than daytime stuff where we could potentially use medicines, but treating enuresis is delicate because there's no cutoff. There's no, you know, by this age, this child should be dry because, again, you know, there's some family hereditary component, but then also a large part has to do with the motivation of the child. And so it can be very frustrating for parents. I completely empathize with them. You're changing bed sheets every day. You're buying new mattresses every month, pads, pull-ups, everything. It's very frustrating. But then you see the child who's sitting there playing on the phone or just smiling, and you ask them, does this bother you? And they're like, eh, not really. Then, you know, the conversation has to shift to the part where, you know, we can't really address it until the child is ready to address it. But that's usually when those sleepovers start to happen, or summer camps. You know, they want to travel, they want a vacation, they are part of football camp, whatever it is. And that's usually when the motivation of the child kicks in. And then they're like, oh my goodness, I have to get dry. How do I do this? And then there's all of a sudden, you know, this very much hurry up and fix this immediately. And so that's the first piece in terms of talking about timing of things. Now, if the 8-year-old is not interested, I tell the parents, give it some more time. Wait till they're past 10. If they're still wetting and now they're seeming like they want to participate in social activities and they can't, bring him back or her, and then we can restart this conversation. But generally speaking, I do not recommend treatment for really children less than 6 years old. But there's really no strict age cutoff. There are children who are 7 or 8, super mature, want to do things, and they are like, let's go.
So let's take, you know, Nathan, he's 8. He's trying to go for sleepovers. He's feeling it. You know, he's like, I am concerned. This is not fun. What is kind of your first line? Oh, and we'll also say, just to be very clear, that this is just nighttime and nocturnal enuresis. This is not daytime incontinence, with which we just talked about. What is the treatment? And so how would you start?
Yeah. So there are several therapies that have been shown to work for nighttime incontinence or bedwetting. Really, the two big ones that I talk about is the bedwetting alarm or the bedwetting monitor and desmopressin or DDAVP. Which one, I counsel the parents on both of them and the risks, the benefits, the challenges to both of them. And whether, they pick one or the other is a lot up to the family and the social dynamics. And I'll get to that in a second. So let me at least first explain how the bedwetting alarm works, because it's not how you think it works. It's not how parents think it works, because these parents usually will come to me saying, okay, I'm waking this child up every 2 hours. Now you're telling me you're giving me an alarm that does the same thing. Well, I've already been doing that for years or for months. Well, the bedwetting monitor actually works the opposite, meaning the alarm only goes off when the child has wet the bed, okay? And then in order for the whole system to actually work, the whole idea of it to work, the child has to get up, go to the bathroom, finish voiding, and they have to be actually alert enough in order for the brain to register that they have wet the bed, right? And so usually what I tell parents is, all right, make sure that you get them to change the sheets, change the bed, turn on the lights, walk to the bathroom downstairs, come back up. Because really, while we don't completely understand how nocturnal enuresis works, the sort of running theory is that there is some sort of miscommunication or maturation delay with the brain. And that's important to know, because I do tell parents really the only thing that fixes enuresis is time. But the monitor kind of helps speed that up a little bit. And so you really need retraining of the brain and sort of the recommunication with the bladder during nighttime in order for the brain to over time wake up the child before they wet. And so it works almost the opposite of what you think. Parents waking them up before the child wets the bed doesn't allow the brain to interpret that this is actually the wrong behavior. And so this can take months. I usually counsel parents to do this during a holiday break or summertime, because it can be very disruptive. If they share a room with a sibling or a cousin, then, this is going to be really disruptive for the other person and it may not work. And then it requires a very dedicated parent to basically wake up with the child. The child's going to try to sleep through that alarm. And the goal is to have the child wake up. And so usually the parent has to sleep either next door or right in the room with the child and actually get the child to physically wake up. And so the parent essentially is waking up with the child, for several months every night trying to deal with this. And really, the bedwetting monitor only really works for patients who have fairly consistent episodes of bedwetting per week. If it doesn't really work if they're only wetting once or twice a week, it really only works if it's the vast majority of the week. So those are the caveats or sort of the intricacies of the bedwetting alarm that I let parents know. And there are some very motivated parents who actually would prefer this, because it's not medication. It's rewiring of the brain. It's the actual only evidence-based method of, quote, treating bedwetting. And so they like that. They hear that it's backed by science, and it's not a Band-Aid. And so, once there's at least 14 consecutive dry nights with the bedwetting alarm, that's considered you're good. You're treated. So I do tell parents, you may have some good nights and bad nights, but we're not out of the woods until we've got 2 full weeks where he hasn't wet the bed. Then I think he's good. The other sort of option that I often counsel parents on is desmopressin or DDAVP. And actually, a lot of pediatricians feel pretty comfortable giving this medication, because it's been around for decades. And so it's proven to be very, very efficient in children, specifically in children who actually produce a lot of urine at nighttime and that they have good bladder function. It's a pill. So, it's not as disruptive on the other, family members in the house. It's easily titratable. It's a tiny little pill. You can start off, this comes in 0.2 milligrams per pill, I believe. You can start off with just one pill about an hour before nighttime, bedtime. And then you can give it a few days. If it doesn't work, then you can titrate it up to 0.4. And then the maximum dose of 0.6 milligrams or 3 pills. But the caveat of the pill is that they have to be very careful about fluid restriction. There have been, you know, of course, as we know, sort of a black box warning almost of the incredibly dangerous risk of hyponatremia. And so, you know, I kind of just really hound it in these parents. I don't make them sign a contract. I do know some urologists who will document that, you know, they sign a contract saying that they understand this risk, because obviously it's a devastating risk if it can happen. And often these kids are waking up in the middle of the night. They're like, okay, I guess I'll go use the bathroom or whatever. I got wet, and they're going to the refrigerator and pulling a glass of water to drink at the same time, right? And so I really, really carefully counsel that these children must not drink, you know, a couple hours before bedtime. They have to pee before they go to bed. And really just one tiny little glass, about 8 ounce, when they take the pill, and then that's it.
So speaking of the limiting the fluids before bed, it, again, you mentioned the fact that, like, the kid has to be ready. Mm-hmm. Is there any role for behavioral modifications that could apply whether or not the kid is ready? So things like limiting fluids before bed, double voiding before bed, anything else I might not be thinking of there?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think usually by the time the parents come to me, they've already done all those things. But, you know, you'd be surprised. I think that, you know, oftentimes parents don't realize, oh, goodness, yeah, you're right. You know, he's drinking 2 glasses of milk, you know, at 6 o'clock during dinner, and then he's not peeing before he goes to bed. And then we're going to bed at 7:30, 8 o'clock, and he's going to bed with almost a full bladder. Well, goodness, of course, you know, he's going to have issues trying to kick his, you know, enuresis. And so that's a great sort of little litmus test for me as a provider. You know, you have to do these things. Make sure that you're doing the daytime stuff, pooping every day, emptying your bladder before you go to bed, limiting your fluids. And if you're doing all those things already, and then you're still having issues, then, you know, that tells me that the child is motivated. Honestly, by the time they get to my office, the child is motivated.
I think voiding before bed, incredibly important. And then especially, hopefully they can do that with after getting DDAVP, but I assume it's whatever's in the bladder already kind of before it starts working. My question more for that hyponatremia component is, do you recommend any sort of monitoring blood work wise to go for hyponatremia, or do you assume that they don't take enough so it's out of their system by the time you'd even get a lab, and so we just hope everything goes well?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think that lab studies or checking for hyponatremia is really indicated in this case, because it's such a rapid onset. I mean, I think the half-life is like 2 or 3 hours. And so there's really no good way to monitor for this, because you just take it at nighttime and it's out of your system by the day, by daytime. And, you know, those are sort of historical risks, but those are real risks. And so when we talk about hyponatremia, I specifically say seizures, right? Because that's what we worry about with fluid retention from desmopressin. And the intranasal version of desmopressin is really the one that's most associated with the hyponatremic seizures. So we don't give that. I don't give the intranasal version. I don't even know how to write for it, to be honest. I just give the pill form. And I think there's been maybe some potential case reports on this, but it's almost borderline theoretical. But I still, because of the devastating effects of, you know, seizures, I tell them, you know, look out for these signs. You know, if they're having fevers, if they're having, you know, sort of any signs of fluid imbalance, electrolyte imbalance, or vomiting, or having diarrhea, they're just not acting themselves, you know, bring them to the ER immediately. And that's usually enough to freak out the parents, that sometimes it'll push them towards doing the bedwetting alarm versus, you know, just being really careful with the medicine. I will say the advantage of the DDAVP, which I have done for parents who are a little bit worried about taking it nightly because, you know, they're worried about hyponatremia or they just don't want their child to be on a pill every day, is that it can be given as needed, which is brilliant for children who, you know, are usually at home all the time and parents don't mind changing the bed sheets, but they may have that weekend trip or football game on the road, and they just want that overnight sort of effect for that just one night, in which case DDAVP is great. It's great for something like that. I'm a big proponent of a PRN use of DDAVP. I do tell parents, you know, if they are coming to me for the first time and have never used DDAVP, don't try it, you know, on the day of the trip, because you don't know how much you need. Do you need one, two, or three pills? And so, you know, a few days or a week before your trip, go ahead and trial it, see what works, and then that's going to be your dose that you take with you.
And just from a PRN standpoint, I would just want to know if you counsel on the opposite, like, don't do it if you're sick. Don't do it if you're running fevers. Don't do it when you're like anything,
diarrhea.
Yeah, diarrhea, you know, all that type of stuff. Do you also make that point, or is it actually going to be okay?
I do to some extent, not to that degree. I think if they have been using it for quite some time, they're usually pretty good about monitoring it. And we check with them, you know, telehealth visits to make sure. But I do tell them to monitor. Hey, if you're, you know, if you've noticed that he's been drinking a lot because he's really sick or dehydrated or whatever, you know, you can always just not take it that day and it's fine. And I do tell them about taking holidays from the desmopressin, because we do have to be able to assess whether this child has actually outgrown their enuresis. If they're on it all the time, you're not going to be able to know. And so I tell them the best time to do is during summertime. You know, take them off of it, see how they do for a good couple of weeks. If it seems like, hey, it's not great, you know, they're back leaking or wetting, then put them back on it. If they're not, then great, maybe we don't need it anymore. A common question that I get asked, I think, from pediatricians is, can I combine the therapies? I generally don't recommend it. I think it can. There's been some sort of studies on combination therapy with the enuresis alarm and the desmopressin. In my head, it feels like they're almost contradicting each other, because you do want to have that leakage with the bedwetting alarm for the bedwetting alarm to work. And so if you're suppressing the bedwetting, the alarm is not really going to be effective. Now, you can combine desmopressin with other medications. And we sometimes see that if we've maxed out on the 0.6 milligrams of DDAVP and it seems like, oh my goodness, still having issues. The next line that I would consider is potentially oxybutynin or ditropan. And I would give it at nighttime and just add that on and see how they do. And oftentimes the combination actually does have some synergistic effect in sort of helping with the nighttime wetting.
Thanks. I have one really quick question, just behaviorally again. Is it problematic to have kids who are not taking any of these therapies in pull-ups kind of until they have dry nights? Or is there a point where the parents need to switch them to underwear just because it's some sort of behavioral signal to them that, oh, then they're going to know they're wet and that'll help them to start getting those natural signals?
The answer is probably not. And this goes back to sort of understanding bedwetting and sort of the mechanism of that. What we do know is it's really brain signals to the innervation or the nerve endings to the bladder. So I don't think it's necessarily to the perineal skin being wet or not. It really has to do with how full the bladder is. There's just a delay. And I will tell you that anecdotally, it has to do a lot with patients who are deep sleepers. So I do ask about that too. Is he someone who's hard to arouse? If Nathan is, and is in our prompt, then, you know, that could point also to another reason that, you know, they're having a little bit of issue. And that's the other reason why it's important to emphasize, if we're using the bedwetting alarm, that he has to be fully aroused, fully awake, in order to let the brain retrain. I say retrain, but it's really letting the brain mature to understand the fullness of the bladder.
So I really appreciate the time you spent today talking about both, you know, all these different types of incontinence and dysfunction, urinary dysfunction. One question I have is just sort of stepping back, looking at both these, I guess, multiple different types of etiologies for these diseases that we talked about today. You know, can you discuss a little bit about maybe some of the social disparities that we might be seeing and things we need to be aware of as we're approaching our children with these types of issues?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, health disparities do really play a huge role in dysfunctional voiding and anuresis, particularly in families where they may have poor access to getting healthcare products. You know, these children need to be in pull-ups or pads, special underwear. And when it comes to health literacy, I feel like a lot of parents don't understand that the children aren't doing this on purpose. And that is a very multifactorial problem or condition. And on top of that, you know, it's not a condition that can be quickly fixed. And so it's a huge, huge burden for these parents who may have poor access to healthcare. For these parents who may have to travel very far to see a specialist to figure out what's going on. And so, yeah, I do think that this is an area of research that really needs to be investigated. The fact that there isn't a lot of evidence-based evidence-based medicine for this, with the exception of the DDAVP and bedwetting alarm, which, as you can imagine, in a family who already is struggling to have to provide for special care for this child, now you're telling them that in a home where they potentially have a lot of children staying with them, other family members, a bedwetting alarm could be very disruptive, for instance. And it's just not feasible. And when some therapies require medications, that's a cost that they may not be able to, you know, afford. And so, yeah, I think that health disparities is very important to consider for this population and should be part of this discussion. What are the realistic goals for this family? What can we do to help them? And then again, just going back and emphasizing that it's not the child's fault, particularly if the child's not particularly motivated to get these fixed. I think families have a problem understanding that the motivation of the child is a critical component of treating, you know, incontinence daytime or nighttime.
Yeah, I think a recent example where I sort of ran into something similar was, you know, I had a child who had anuresis and they couldn't do bed alarms because, you know, it was a single parent household and they worked at night. And so it was like a grandparent who was at nighttime who, you know, not really the one who's going to be able to get up and down really quickly and help the kids out. And, you know, it was just, you know, the logistics and the feasibility was just so difficult. And we ended up opting to do desmopressin. And it just seemed to make more sense looking at the logistics of everything. So it's something that I think we all definitely face often with a lot of our patients that have these symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely.
Should we go into take-home points, guys?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So, again, you've spent a long time with us today. You said you've discussed two lectures worth of material and basically covered your entire clinic. So I appreciate you spending all this time explaining these things to us and helping us out. If you can, would you be able to give us, you know, some of your main take-home points to our listeners before we go?
Okay, how much time do we have? Because a lot of take-home points. I think the biggest take-home points that I want our listeners to sort of remember about, I'm going to focus sort of daytime incontinence and bedwetting maybe a little bit separately, but there are, I think, overarching themes here. It's that it's very common, both of them. Daytime incontinence is extremely common. And, you know, I think the number one thing is education with the families and reassurance. They come hand in hand. While there is no quick fix, which is important to set expectations in these circumstances, it is important for the parents to realize that treatment of incontinence in general usually requires several different therapies that could be medical or pharmacologic or behavioral or dietary. And we do have to do this in a stepwise fashion. Parents often will ask for just a quick fix, and unfortunately, there really isn't. And the parents have to be very dedicated and diligent in following, you know, the urotherapy guidelines. And that's, you know, making sure they void regularly, address the bowels, eat the right stuff, drink the right stuff, going to the bathroom frequently. Those are sort of the overarching themes to urotherapy before we can start moving into more invasive options. When it comes to bedwetting, you know, again, setting expectations is important. And then also being very honest that time is really the only thing that can help cure bedwetting. There is really nothing else. The bedwetting alarm will help speed it up a little bit by, quote, rewiring the brain or helping, you know, the brain mature faster. But there is really no quick fix. And the DDAVP, I tell parents, is just a Band-Aid. When you take them off, if the brain is not ready yet, they will go back to the habit of bedwetting. And it's not the child's fault. They're not doing it on purpose, which is a very key component of my counseling with these parents. They're not wetting the bed because they're lazy. And that goes for daytime incontinence. I think a lot of parents think their child's just lazy and then just decide to leak into the underwear. And that's absolutely not the case most of the time.
All right. Well, as we wrap up here, yeah, is there anything you want our listeners to check out? Anything you want to plug? Any associations, websites, tools that you want us to look at before you go?
Yeah, I think if you want more details about urotherapy, incontinence, there is the International Children's Continence Society, it's the ICCS. They come out with these guidelines, consensus statements that are really concise, a couple papers that are readily available on PubMed or at your university library that kind of just outlines a lot of the things that we talked about. And it's really easy to follow. They are the figures that I include in my presentations all the time. And ICCS is sort of one of our big governing bodies in terms of incontinence in children. So big shout out to ICCS.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for spending this time with us. I learned a whole bunch, and I'm sure our listeners learned a whole bunch too. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes and sign up for our bi-weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our producer for this episode, Sydney Engel, and our wonderful social media coordinator, Denise Cruz, on X, Blue Sky, and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
I've been Sydney Engel.
And this has been Chris the Chumanchu. Thank you and good night. And as always, a gift to those who've made it all the way to the end, a poem written by AI. This one's titled, When Nature Calls. In daylight hours and dark of night, some children face a unique plight where bladder signals go astray or sleep keeps wetness held at bay. As doctors, first we start to trace each pattern's time in every place. Through voiding diaries neat and clean, we map out what these patterns mean. Daytime drips and urgent speed tell tales of what the child may need, from overactive bladder squeeze to holding patterns ill at ease. When darkness falls and dreams take flight, some beds grow damp in deepest night. Nocturnal enuresis shows what deep sleep patterns might disclose. Our tools range wide to help them cope, from alarms that bring them hope to timed voiding steady way and medicines that light the way. Through constipation's pressing weight or ADH that runs too late, with patience, time, and gentle care, we help them reach the dryness there. Have a good one, guys. Bye.